Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, I'm Sophie Ellis-Bextor, and welcome to Spinning Plates, the podcast where I speak to busy working women who also happen to be mothers about how they make it work. I'm a singer, and I've released 7 albums in between having my 5 sons, aged 16 months to 16 years, so I spin a few plates myself. Being a mother can be the most amazing thing, but can also be hard to find time for yourself and your own ambitions. I want to be a bit nosy and see how other people balance everything. Welcome to Spinning Plates. Hello, good morning. That's very presumptuous of me. Just because it's morning for me doesn't mean it's morning for you. For me, it's just got 9 o'clock on Sunday. And I'm recording this, some might say it's a little risky. My 2-year-old's in the garden, I can see him. I can hear him, he's chatting, but he's busy. So I thought I'd seize the moment. I've got 2 others, my 5-year-old and 8-year-old are watching a movie in the other room. I've just made them pancakes, so they'll be fine for a minute. And then my 12-year-old and 16-year-old are still fast asleep. I'll probably have to get them up at some point. So I'm having a cup of tea, just had my breakfast, and I thought I would chat to you and let you know about this week's podcast. Thank you so much for the lovely feedback about last week's. It's good to be back with the third series. I loved my chat with Jack Monro, and I'm so happy that you all liked it as much as me. I felt like, again, a lot of wisdom in there. How lucky am I that I get to hear so much brilliant advice, and just I would genuinely say every single podcast chat I've had, I take something away from the conversation, stays with me, and that is a lovely feeling. So this week is no exception. I spoke to Jess Phillips, who is Labour MP for Birmingham Yardley, and my producer Claire and I travelled up to see her in person. We went, must have been sort of October, November kind of time, when we were allowed to go, I know that much. But now that feels just like a weird idea, because obviously we haven't been going anywhere for a while. But anyway, we went to Birmingham. We arrived a little early, Claire and I, so we had a little fried egg and bacon sandwich outside the office. And then Jess arrived bang on time. We went into her office on the road, which was very, very, very Jess, actually, because it was completely accessible. She had loads of cards up all over the place from her happy constituents and messages and lots of information there from what was going on in their lives, and so she's brilliantly engaged with her constituents. But also the place itself had no heating. It was pretty basic, but I guess that's not the priority, which is what I like about Jess and why I want to speak to her, because to me she represents what, as a kid, I thought all MPs were like. Engaged with the people she represents, very outspoken, very bright, funny about life, but also very aware of what needs to be done where and how to help social change from the ground up. That's honestly what I thought MPs were all like. It took me a while to realise that's not how it always is. Jess has 2 little boys with her partner Tom. She, like me, got pregnant very quickly into that relationship. And the other thing that resonated with me, Jess and I are about the same age, and she also found that having her first kid really harnessed her ambition, and I felt like that too. I did a lot of work before I had my first baby. Sorry, it's the sound of my 2-year-old putting a truck along outside. I did do a lot of work before I had Sonny, but after I had him, I thought, right, every minute when I'm working away from him has to count, and it really focused me. So I totally get that as well. But anyway, enough of my blabber. I've already got my cup of tea, so I won't be going off to make my tea like I normally do. It's here. It's getting a bit cold, to be honest with you. So I'll sit here, drink my lukewarm tea, and listen in, and see you on the other side. Thanks for lending me your ears once more.
Hello,
Yeah, thank you so much for letting me come and speak to you. I really wanted to speak to you for so many reasons, not least, I think, because as an MP, you're kind of what I always, when I was growing up, imagined what an MP would be like. Someone that's really engaged with her constituency, speaks up for what she believes in, passionate, pretty ballsy, just sort of firmly ensconced in the politics of our society rather than in all the sort of the society that's in politics, I guess. But yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's true, but I heard that you wanted to be Prime Minister from when you were really small.
I did, yeah.
That's which I first think, I think is adorable, by the way.
I mean, I think the only thing you can describe it as is adorable, because, I mean, it's just sort of slightly, you know, I can only, the worst thing about it is I can only really put it down to Margaret Thatcher, who was the Prime Minister when I was 4 years old, and I must have just thought, I'll do that job. That she's, you know, she's doing it. Yeah. I definitely wasn't going to do it like her, though, because we weren't even allowed to say her name in our house.
Yeah, well, actually, it's the same in my house. And funnily enough, we're pretty much the same age. I'm just a little bit older than you. And at my school, we had to do something where we had to fill in like a sort of mock-up of a newspaper front cover and do My Hero. And I decided to draw the night that my dad had gone down the road and stood up on top of the local car wash to rip down a massive Margaret Thatcher poster, which is probably something you can get in big trouble for. But I did this very detailed drawing of my dad ripping down this
Well,
poster.
Your dad and my dad both. My dad used to go around with like a bread knife on a stick to get down the posters for the opposing political parties.
Really? Wow.
Because they were done like high up on string. So he had manufactured essentially like a shillelagh to take down the posters.
I think our dads would have a lot to talk
about.
Yeah,
absolutely. We don't allow it in Birmingham anymore. And actually, you don't see it in London. It used to be like at election time, there would be posters and stuff everywhere, but we don't allow it on the lamppost anymore. There was some sort of, you know, bylaw set in the West Midlands that doesn't allow it. But, you know, that's really put people like my dad out of a really good election job that he used to have. He used to put the posters up as well. And there was always this like battle of who could get their poster on the top.
The highest bit.
Yeah.
Where your dad's bread knife on a stick would reach. Is he still very politically engaged, your dad?
Oh, yeah, really, really. In fact, he just rang me to talk to me. And I was in the middle of doing an unconscious bias training that Parliament has put on. And my dad had rung me twice and sent me a message saying, call me as soon as you can. The first thing that he wanted to know was when my nephew's, his grandson's birthday was. It's not for like 6 weeks, so it was not an urgent call. And the second thing was, he wanted to talk to me about Dominic Cummings and whether he will leave before Christmas. And I was like, okay, all right, Dad, this was not the urgency that I expected. Well, from my father, who is nearly 80, has cancer and is shielding. When you say call me ASAP, I would like it not to be about Dominic Cummings.
And month and a half away birthdays. Oh, yeah. Well, I suppose you grew up in that political house, like your dad being obviously very engaged, and your mum as well, Gather, was very sort of active with her campaigning.
Yes,
and
she was. She was a political activist in the local Labour Party as much as anything else, but my mum's activism was much more issue-based, so around feminism and around sort of injustices. So she, when she was quite young, she was 24, 25, which seems phenomenal to me now that my mum was ever that age, but she had two kids like me. She had her kids at a very similar age to me, so she was quite young, although back then she was probably considered geriatric. She had taken on a big, massive pharmaceutical company, ICI, the biggest pharmaceutical company in the country, because they had given my nan a drug. They developed a drug that was given for heart disorders, angina, and they gave it to my nan, and it basically made my nan go blind and stopped it. It's like the most poetic thing that happened. So they tried like to cure my nan's broken heart and they dried up her tears. So it's literally like the most poetic injustice that has ever occurred. My nan actually didn't have any sort of heart problem, but because she was a woman and they don't test it, they don't do any proper medical research, they, you know, she'd maybe been a bit breathless once, so they gave her this medication. And it dried up her tears. So when I was little, we used to have to, every hour, we used to have to like drag tissues, wet tissues across my nan's eyes to clear out her eyes. Because it was like, for her, any light going into her eyes was like sandpaper on her eyes because it was full of grit. And my mum successfully found, with a number of other campaigners, thousands of people who'd suffered this same effect across the country.
Wow.
This is in 1976.
Yeah.
How on earth did she find anybody?
How?
I've read some of the newspaper archives about it, and it is just like, you know, going in, having local church hall meetings. And
wow, your mum. That's amazing.
Just unbelievable that she sort of travelled around the country trying to find these people. She had a two-year-old and a newborn baby. But they were successful, and when all the claims were in by like the 1983, they'd sued them for like £12 million in total back then. That's obviously an enormous fortune, and given it out to all the people who had suffered. And when you grow up in that sort of environment where if something is wrong, you do something about it. Then that will inevitably rub off on you. It's like being raised by Erin Brockovich. Although I have to say, I wasn't really cognizant of all this work that my mum had done when I was little, because why would you be? But we had a cupboard in our house that was called the Araldin cupboard. And I thought that an Araldin cupboard was like a cupboard that everybody had in their house, like an airing cupboard. But Araldin was the name of the drug, and it's where she kept all the case studies of...
Wow.
My dad had gone out and found it in an auction, this big cupboard, so she could keep all the case studies from around the country. And so it was forever... We still call it, the glasses are now kept in the Araldin cupboard. We call it the Araldin cupboard, but I just thought it was like a Poang. Like, I thought that like everybody had an Araldin cupboard, like a Billy bookcase.
Exactly. If you see something similar in someone, like, oh, you've got an Araldin cupboard.
Exactly. And they would be like, is that what it's called? And I'd be like, yeah, that's definitely, that's the official name of that. That's an Araldin.
I want to buy one on eBay. I'm going to look one up. Well, I suppose as well, when you're a kid, actually, you've always automatically got a very good sense of what's fair, actually. Mm. Children are born with that quite innately, aren't they? So maybe your mum acting upon it felt quite logical. It's only really when you reflect, when you're older, that you realise the energy and effort. And also the fact that most people grow out of feeling the impetus to actually do anything.
Absolutely.
But then what your nan went through sounds horrible. And, you know... very unjust, and so I suppose that's a big fuel to put on the fire, isn't it?
Yeah, but my nan had raised my mum to be like that. So, you know, my nan was one of the, like, she was just from around the corner from here. She was a single parent in the 1950s, which was unheard of, and she was a dinner lady at one of the local schools. I remember in the 80s, like, my nan would be the first person who'd like chain herself to something.
Wow.
Something was going, like, you know, she would stick up against like skinheads on the bus and things if they were being racist. And she was like deeply offended by South Africa, my nan, like the fact that the South African team didn't have any black players or didn't allow black players. I remember my nan literally spoke of nothing else and she used to pick me up from school every Thursday and give me a Kit Kat and a ham sandwich.
An update
on what is happening. And back then, parliamentary PMQs, Prime Minister's Questions, was on a Thursday. It's now on a Wednesday. But my nan would always pick me up from school on a Thursday. And when we got home, she would stand and do all of our ironing, make her sound like a scullery maid. She would do all the ironing. So the smell of the iron reminds me of my nan, like fresh, clean washing. And watch Prime Minister's Questions. And I would just sit there with her watching Prime Minister's Questions. And so to me, like, the most working class people were deeply politically engaged and deeply activated to do things and change things. So that is the environment that I grew up in. Mm. It wasn't like, you know, I never even considered that my nan was a kind of person who might not have much agency, because she was born in 1913, left by her... she was put into it as an orphan when her mother died because her dad didn't want her anymore, but he kept her son. Their son, and married someone else and raised a family. And my nan was literally sent into service of a wicked aunt, where she was basically a maid. And then she got out of that by marrying my grandfather, who I liked, but was a terrible philanderer and sexist, and treated her appallingly. My mum used to tell this story about how my nan never knew this even before she had died, but my mum had kept this secret for her dad, that my nan had taken off her engagement ring to do the washing up and then couldn't find it, and, like, you know, had the drains cleaned out and everything. But what had happened was that my granddad had stolen it from the side of the sink, pawned it to pay for an abortion for a mistress. So, yeah, so, you know, I really loved my granddad, and he lived with me when I was a child. He was one of the people who brought me up. But, you know, he wasn't a cracking husband, but he was probably better than living in servitude. And so, you know, I knew all this sort of folklore and stories about my nan and my granddad, who, like I say, lived with me till I was 16, moved in when I was two until I was 16, that these were deeply working class people who'd been born in areas of Birmingham that had been cleared in the slum clearance. Mm. And they were deeply politically activated, and they owned politics as far as I was concerned. So that is what I grew up with, that, that politics is for those people. So I was shocked when I met other people who were like really posh and in politics.
Yeah, or even meet so many people where politics is almost kept in a box.
Yeah,
like it's some, yeah, exactly, yeah. Like compartmentalised. Whereas, you know, one of my overwhelming thoughts after we had the referendum was that I must make sure my kids don't feel that way about politics. I must make sure that to them it's not a kind of an add-on to their life, but they understand how all those strands affect their everyday life. I mean, you were telling me that normally when your constituents can come and see you, it's all manner of everyday life that they bring you.
I mean, it's literally anything that you can imagine, like from the sublime to the ridiculous. Like one woman rang up once and said, there's, you know, I had a new patio done and there's some slabs in my garden. They're at the bottom of the garden and I can't clear them. She had a private house,
so their own slabs. To go around.
It's just like, what are you going to do about these slabs?
Yeah, I'm not sure that is political.
I don't think that is, but eventually, in the end, I just made my husband go and clear
really?
Them. He's got a van. I was just like, can you just get rid of this woman's slabs, please? Because I can't bear this anymore.
No. And you can't fight every battle.
You can't fight every
battle. If someone's calling you out with
just
that.
Just like, oh God, do you know what? I'll send someone round. I've got a good husband. He's got a van. He'll come and clear the slabs. And so, you know, you get everything. When I go into schools, I try and explain to kids that literally the sort of fabric that are in the clothes of their uniform is decided by a piece of legislation. There is nothing that anybody eats or wears or does that there isn't some piece of legislation that governs what way that has to be done.
Yeah.
And people don't realise that it's and maybe I didn't realise until I had to sit on some of those committees discussing literally the tiny minutia of some regulation. I was like, Jesus, who knew there was rules about this?
No, I know. I bet not small Jess Phillips back when she wanted to be Prime Minister thought, is this really what I thought politics would be like? But you mentioned that your mum was a real feminist, and so to what extent was that displayed in the marriage she had with your dad? Was it, because I know you've spoken a lot about being very equal with your husband. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you saw growing
up? Yes, absolutely, 100%. Maybe my brothers would have a different answer to this question, because they were born in the 1970s.
I'm one of four. So where are you in the lineup?
I'm the end. I'm the last one.
Baby.
She definitely
most
has
popular.
Had enough. I'm definitely the most popular.
Yeah.
There's literally
the
no two
spot.
Ways about it.
In a big family, it's a peachy spot.
Also, the only girl as well. Like, you know, they're quite. Although my mum used to say she hated it when people were like, oh God, are you relieved you got a girl? Like, she hadn't loved the boys.
Yeah.
But the answer was absolutely yes, if she'd been honest. She was delighted to have a daughter. but when I was growing up, my mum went back to work when I was about 18 months old. And I have, since she died, I'd read this. She'd been obviously like writing a diary, or not like in any sort of organised way, just some random pieces of paper that I found after she died. And it is, I mean, it is the most sort of harrowing, true account of what it is like to have a tiny baby. And it's literally talking about how I've dragged myself up in my cot bars and I'm screaming and she cannot do anything to stop me crying. I just think that maybe I was such a pain in the arse that she thought, you know what, I'm going to go back to work. I'm going to go and do something with my life. So for most of my mother's life as a mother before me, she had worked and done bits, and she got a degree before she had my eldest brother. But she'd been a civil servant at the GPO and done bits and pieces helping out in academic research and stuff. But she didn't really work, and my dad was the main breadwinner. But it was the 1970s, you know. It was, if you basically, if you're from around here and you're a woman who works, you work in a factory or you're a teacher. I think those were the two options. Mm. But she, so I think at that point she went back to work and she was like a sort of personal assistant in a sort of big public sector, sort of charity, in big public sector and charity organisations, and then worked her way up. But by the time I was about seven, my mum was like a sort of top executive in an organisation that was around how health authorities work. And my dad had retired early and was sort of dwindling down. And so to me, the person who cooks your dinner is your dad. My dad did all the cooking, all the cleaning. My granddad moved in with us to help with childcare when my mum went back to work when I was two. And so he was the person who picked me up from school. My granddad picked me up from school before my dad got home from work. Then my dad did all the cooking and cleaning. My brothers were always encouraged much more to do that sort of thing than I ever was. They can all cook considerably better than me. Mm-hmm. I married a man who can cook incredibly well, so that life skill is lost on me forever. And so they definitely lived that out in their lives. And my dad never ever got any sense of him feeling emasculated or that being an issue in my parents' marriage,
which actually is pretty modern thinking considering
totally
that decade
and
that
they
time.
Definitely didn't necessarily come from that. They came from much more traditional women, although they, to be fair, both my nana and my granny, you wouldn't mess with either of them. And both my the people they went on to have successful marriages with, not my actual biological grandfather, but my step granddad and my dad's dad, were both very calm, nice, gentle men, and the women were tough.
Mm. And has it trickled down? I'm curious to know if your brothers have quite equal marriages in that way. Does it trickle down to how they are? You don't have to go into loads of detail about their marriages, their relationships.
Yes, they do.
In general.
They do. They definitely do an equal share of childcare, without question. The ones that have children, one of my brothers doesn't have any children, but they definitely do have, they definitely take the lion's share of the cooking. And my brother Sam, who's married to a French woman, she cannot stop cleaning. I literally have to tie her down. it's actually more annoying than you think. It's a service. She comes to stay with us at Christmas and she never sits still. I'm like, we don't iron sheets.
No.
Just whack them straight on
the
bed.
Some people iron sheets.
Come
on. Life's too short.
Some people iron knickers. What the hell?
What?
But she just loves to clean. But yeah, my brother does all the cooking and things and shopping and then looking after. But it's not even, it doesn't feel particularly noteworthy. It is the way that we, and to my husband, it's not a shock either.
No, I think that's all really positive. And I'm raising five boys, and I would say that they're all going to be, you know, the ones that are old enough to know about it are already, you know, firmly in the feminist camp. And in fact, I was having a really good chat yesterday with my 16-year-old because we were flicking through one of the sort of shopping Christmas catalogues and got to the bit with the toys, and there's all this very, very traditional role play already in the kids' toys, with all the little girls playing with the dolls and with the buggy and the bag for the baby. And then you get the boys' stuff and they're playing with guns and dinosaurs and construction. And it's so disappointing. I find it such an uphill, like, come on, it's 2020. We were aware of this when I was a teenager. Sounds like your parents were aware of it when they were younger.
Totally.
It's like, you know, come on, haven't we really got a bit more expansive in our idea of...
Why is there girl Lego now?
And
there is like a girl Lego.
So
like, we were fine with just Lego.
Yeah.
We all just had that moon base that you had to stick the
things to.
It
was actually only like three colours when I was a kid, wasn't it?
I mean,
like grey, white and red is all I really remember.
ridiculous that there is
Lego Friends, as they call it. Make a little cafe and, it's, I know.
Anybody ever made out of Lego in my experience was cars or just like a house that never had a pitched roof, always a flat roof. And just that, why do we need...
Unless you're talking to me, in which case I made a 5-story Lego Ninjago city during lockdown, which is really beautiful, obviously following instructions.
I mean, we made, my kids do.
Like, totally,
my
not
kids
we,
do
me.
That now.
I did it on my own.
We made, when I say we, I had literally no part in it other than watching the Friends marathon while we made it. We made the Friends
set. That's a great set.
Oh my gosh, it's amazing.
I love the little cameras and everything. Attention to detail.
It's so amazing. But now we want the whole soundstage. We want all of the different apartments and everything.
Yes.
But my son Danny, he was like, that's what he wanted for his birthday. So we bought that and we said, let's just watch Friends and make the Friends set. So that's what we did. And I just watched the Friends.
And how old are Harry and Danny now?
They are, so Harry is 15 in the last year of doing his GCSEs or whatever is going to happen.
Question mark.
And Danny has just started secondary school, so he's just turned 12.
So there's something we have sort of in common, because I understand you met your husband and found out you're having a baby quite early on.
Literally within weeks.
Yes, same for me. So
to be fair to me, I can't speak for you. I didn't meet him then. I had met him I've known him a long, long time.
Okay.
But I just started going out with him.
Well, that's actually similar again.
Okay, that's okay.
Yeah.
No judgment here.
If that had been the case, it'd be fine. But yeah, no, I knew Richard for about a year and a half before we started dating. After 6 weeks, we found out there was a baby on the way, which was a bit of a surprise. So I think you'd been, maybe beat me a bit, so maybe you were 4 weeks, is that right? Like a month?
Yeah, we've been going out for about a month or so. And so obviously, like, I hadn't had a period in the time, but I just thought maybe I just haven't had one. It's only been 4 weeks.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that's perfectly reasonable.
Reasonable. So when you did find out, who were the first people you spoke to about it?
First person I spoke to was Tom. I was in New Street Station when I took the pregnancy test. Very glamorous. as in a toilet, a public toilet, which back then, I'm glad to say, that thanks to the comedian Joe Lycett who campaigned about it, you don't have to pay 20 pence to go into the New Street Station toilet anymore. So I'd paid 20 pence and I had bought one of those ridiculously expensive ones. You can get them much cheaper now. They really have come down in price. Pregnancy tests in the Boots at New Street Station. And it was one of those ones that flashes pregnant at you. Like, you know, pregnant.
It's an excited test.
And I just was like totally flabbergasted. But in that second, and every single time I've taken a pregnancy test, I've had the same feeling. I knew exactly what I was going to do within the first second. And so I just knew that I wanted to have the baby. And I spoke to Tom about it. I rang him and told him that I'd taken a pregnancy test and that I was pregnant. And then and he said, well, what do you want to do about this? And he didn't say one way or another what he thought. And I said, I'm just going to take some time. Even though I knew, I felt like I had to pretend that I didn't know and that we were going to go through a process of thinking about it. That was a total lie. I was going through literally no process. but I pretended that I was going to. And he was like, that's absolutely fine. And then I told my mum. My mum was the first. I went round to my mum's house and I told her. And I just said, I just don't think I'm ready. And she just said to me, you will never be ready. And then she made me that day go to IKEA. Feel like this was a ploy on her part. To be like, look at all this baby stuff and look at these people who are having babies and people buying things for their houses and things.
That was literally the same day.
It was like, she was like, well, I'm going to IKEA. Why don't you come to IKEA with me? You know, I like the meatballs. So I was like, yeah, I'll go to IKEA. And the whole time we just sort of walked around. There's something easy, isn't there, about walking with somebody and talking to them.
Purposeful outing where you could let thoughts come and go.
And she just said to me, you're never, ever, ever going to be ready to have a baby. Don't kid you. She was not, she definitely wasn't campaigning for me to definitely have it. She'd never met Tom at this point. So she was definitely not campaigning for me to have it, although deep down she definitely was. We were both lying to ourselves and each other. and yeah, she just was like, I just don't want you to make the decision based on this idea of a perfect future that you think is going to occur, was basically what she was trying to do.
But meanwhile, here's IKEA showing you the perfect vision of your future.
Look, you could have all these things in your nice house.
In that nice room.
Exactly. It never actually...
It's never perfect, but just have a gaze at what you could
be. That literally never turned out to be the case. But yeah, I remember vividly just walking around IKEA.
Yeah.
But yeah, then we told her. I didn't tell anybody external from us until we decided what we were going to do. But I think we must have decided pretty quickly. I don't remember anything I don't remember me and Tom ever.
Did your friends know you were already dating a bit?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. It was very dramatic when we were in our early 20s. Everybody was involved in everything, weren't they? Like, you know, everything is a drama.
Yeah. So how old were you then?
I was 22 when I got pregnant.
Which is pretty young, isn't it?
Yeah. But my mum was 22 when she had their first baby and was considered to be geriatric.
Mm.
So, 22 was quite young.
In your peers, presumably, that my new friends were having
babies. No, definitely not. And sometimes, this is a terrible admission about the boy that I love very, very much and I'm very glad that he's here on this earth. I sometimes think that maybe I decided that I wanted to keep the baby to have something different and interesting to say. At the first, drama.
Yeah, definitely.
I think that the reality of it is that, you know, when you make those decisions, I think there was some element of check it out, I'm grown up.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I whenever I've been pregnant or had a baby, there's definitely a part of me that feels like I've done something really clever, even though it's not, particularly clever. It's just a sort of sensation of, check this out.
That. I mean, when people used to congratulate Tom, I used to be like, well, he had a broken leg. He literally did nothing. Just lay there. Don't congratulate him. Focus your attention on me.
Yes, please.
This is miraculous what I am actually managing to do. Also, I'd been told that I would struggle to have babies. So that definitely made me sort of crystallise my mind as if this was my only chance. But I think that was just an excuse to try and make an outlandish decision on my part that other people wouldn't have expected me to make.
Yeah, and sometimes I think, you're either one of those people that gets quite excited about the twists and turns that life can throw and sort of runs a bit towards it, or you're not really. And I'm like that as well. I quite like the fact that, you know, all sorts of crazy stuff can happen. Like, so much of life is so reactive. Making plans is never really...
I don't make plans for anything. I never make a plan, ever.
Do you do New Year's resolutions or anything like that?
Every year I say that I'm going to moisturise my skin this year.
Good one.
Every year I do it for 3 days. And
I would say don't bother. Honestly...
Can I just say, you're literally the only person who's ever said that to me, because people cannot believe the idea that I do not moisturise my skin.
I had a revelation a little while back of, I know so many blokes that never moisturise, and your skin is what it is, right? I mean, I'll do it if it feels nice, but I don't do that. I'm glad my mum probably went here, because she's been cleansed, tone, moisturiser was always the mantra.
See, the reason that I don't do it is because my mum washed her face with Pear soap every day and nothing else, and I am one of many boys, and nobody ever brushed my hair or anything. It was just I didn't have pretty plaits or anything, or have any sort of feminine regime to aspire to. And then when I went to university, I was literally like, why are people spending all this time doing all this stuff? This is unbelievable. And the amount of stuff that people take on holiday, I'm like, you could fill up with gin in duty free with the amount of potions that you are bringing on holiday. So yeah, I don't moisturise my skin, but every year I make the sort of first attempt. But I never had spots as a teenager, so maybe that's why
I
never.
I don't think you need moisturiser. I think you're fine. I'm saying, just don't bother with it. No, you know, different New Year's resolution.
I'll just, I don't know.
Mine is always to be a better eBayer, because I never leave feedback, even though I'm very active on eBay. So I'm always I've got to start leaving feedback for these people sending me things.
That is the most niche New Year's resolution I've ever heard. I must give better feedback on, not
just
generally,
some feedback.
Just
some.
On eBay.
eBay, yeah.
I don't really buy things on eBay anymore. Oh. I used to, when I was first pregnant with my son, and off work when he was little, I became obsessed. That was back when people, the jig was not up and you could still buy stuff in charity shops and then flog it for more on eBay. Everybody's at it now.
Yeah,
so.
I know.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Sometimes the transition to fall and winter feels like experiencing every season on the same day. The shoes in the Allbirds Mizzle collection were made for misty morning walks, surprise snow days, and anything a trip to the dog park might bring. The whole collection brings together water-repellent technology and classic style, so you can stay warm, dry, and comfy during your everyday adventures. Check off your errands with the Wool Runner Mizzle. Dash through cold and wet weather with the Wool Dasher Mizzle. Or upgrade to next-level protection with the Wool Runner-Up Mizzle Plus. Go to allbirds.com and use code FRESHSOCKS for a free pair of socks with your purchase. ALLBIRDS.com, code FRESHSOCKS.
So what was happening in your life? Where were you on your sort of political track? Had you stayed clear in your mind from when you were small about working in politics? Was that still on your horizon?
No, when I was 16 years old, my mum at that point was like quite high up in this organisation around the health service. And when I was 16 years old, it was the 50th anniversary of the NHS. It was 1997. Tony Blair had just been elected. And I did my work experience at my mum's organisation that was running this massive conference, and I did it for the week of the conference. And so I was put in with the press team of this conference for the whole national celebration of the 50th anniversary of the NHS. And I watched what the press team, two people who now, obviously Alistair Campbell and Angie, who I know well now, I watched what they did before Tony Blair went somewhere. And they came the day before and they did a walkthrough of the exact people he would talk to and this, that, and the other. And I was literally like, oh, this is not for me. I could not be this controlled about anything. And then that made me want to have a job in politics that wasn't frontline politics. Mm-hmm. This is still very much like the area, the public sector, the area that I am interested in working in. But I don't think that I can basically be told what to speak, think. And I'm not saying Tony Blair was told what to speak, think, but it was very...
Like the job side of it.
It was just very controlled. And I just thought, I'd be shit at this. And my mum was like, you would be really rubbish at this. Don't do this. So then I thought, oh, I'll maybe go to the civil service or work in charity lobbying and that sort of thing. And my mum used to get The Guardian on a Monday. It doesn't exist anymore, this. Used to have all the public sector jobs in it on a Monday. And we would sit and go through the jobs together about the kind of jobs that I might want to have when I grew up. And there was all sorts of like, and everybody seemed to be being paid so much in the public sector. But that was because it was the 1990s, not now.
Yeah.
I think it's not quite so good now.
No. But so when you were 22, what was going on with your work?
I'd finished university. I was working in the pub when me and Tom got together. I was working in my local pub and doing like sort of temporary jobs in different offices and stuff. But then when I took maternity leave, I decided at that point that I wanted to A, go and work in the civil service or do something like that, or become a social worker. And So to become a social worker, you had to have sort of like, to get onto the master's course, because I already had a degree rather than doing an undergraduate degree, you had to go and do like, you know, frontline support work experience. So at that point, I went and I set up like a stay and play group for asylum seekers, because that was easy for me to do with a baby. It was helpful to me as well. And in Ladywood in Birmingham, at the time was during the wars and civil unrest in Sierra Leone, and the end of the civil war in Rwanda, and Birmingham was full of refugees, specific, lots and lots of female women refugees from that area. So we did, and there was terrible, my mum at the time was doing a piece of work on how in that bit of Birmingham, one in three babies died of infant mortality. And
one in three?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, terrible.
Yeah,
terrible. And so my mum was doing this big piece of sort of equalities work around the health service. And so I'd gone and with this charity and set up this stay and play to try and get better access to services for women. I worked with young offenders. I was a support worker for people with Alzheimer's, because I wanted to sort of try every discipline if I was going to be a social worker, to see what I would want to do. And I just absolutely loved doing that sort of work. And so then when I went back to work, when Harry was about 18 months and I started looking for jobs and things, I decided that that was what I wanted to focus on. So I then went and worked at various different charities that worked with various different groups in society, until I wound up working at Women's Aid.
And standing as a candidate with the Labour Party didn't happen until you'd had both your boys?
Both of them, yeah. Both of them were, and even when I became a local councillor, Danny must have been about three, so that was 2012.
And did that feel like a big shift from working at Women's Aid?
Well, not really, because I just basically, I mean, it's different. It's a very different working environment when you work in a place that is only staffed by women and is everybody has common cause, common endeavour, and an outcome, and you're all largely pushing in the same direction. To then going to work in frontline politics when I became a local councillor was eye opening. But I made it about that thing, though. So I became the victim's champion for the city, and I made my role be about the commissioning of vulnerable people's services, so people with substance misuse, offenders, people who've suffered violence against women and girls. And so I just took the skill that I had and adopted it to that new workplace.
And I suppose from the outside looking in, I do feel like politics seems so dominated, frontline politics, I say, so dominated by men, and also this sort of boys' club type feel. Is that an accurate thing for when it's on the inside of it?
It is. It is a very accurate thing. It's got better, I think, and it's certainly, the numbers have got better since I was there. Made that sound like that's all down to me. It's really not. It's down to years and years of the women's movement struggling for that. But no, it is definitely still a boys' club. Even when Theresa May was the Prime Minister and I was there, still felt like a boys' club. You still have to constantly work to remind people that female life experience is a thing. And that is your job, often, is just to say, oh, what can we remember in this policy? Girls exist. And, you know, what about women who work? Should we remember that women have jobs as well when we're talking about the economy? So the default is still very much a boys' club. But There is quite a lot of structure now in place to try and check the default.
Yeah, I mean, I was reading in your book when you were talking about, you know, being a working mother and also just being a woman at work, and how, especially as women get over the age of 40, the gender pay gap, it's still very much a thing.
Yeah, very much.
And also about the inequality of how maternity leave and paternity leave is structured at the moment. And whilst, correct me if I'm wrong with this, whilst men can still take, they can apportion it in a couple about who has which, but there's no incentive for the man to do that. And I think it was Sweden, you said, has got, there's more of a financial incentive for for the father.
It's less of a financial incentive, more of a disincentive, is that you lose your benefits if you don't do it. So, so it's called use it or lose it in Sweden. I spend my whole life working in inequalities, being like, oh, I bet it's better in Sweden. Like, I've started to like be really like, oh, your furniture's better and
it all
things
goes back to
are
IKEA.
Just better. Oh, let me guess, Sweden, the land of milk and honey. So I think I've sort of become like an unconscious bias against the people of Sweden. It was that one IKEA trip that must have done it.
It's not perfect.
Yeah, that's it. Stop with your perfectness. It can't be this good. Some of my friends went to live in Sweden and they said, you know, you're absolutely, you know, it's all right, this much better, things work much better, maternity leave, all this sort of thing, it's all much better, but it is much more controlled society than we have. And I thought, yeah, Sweden, we're free. Free and unequal, but free nonetheless. Terrible reaction. Yeah, the way that these things are structured is that men, basically you're given essentially 9 months of some sort of pay and you share it between you. In fact, David, who is here in the office, he did that with his partner. They shared the leave. But to me, that means it's better than where we were. And if I could have taken that up, I would have. My husband, A, was in a much more secure employment environment that had far better. He worked for a big company. They would have had better pay structures, whereas I only ever got the most basic maternity, state-based maternity pay. And actually, I wouldn't have made those decisions not necessarily on my emotions, but on my finances, the ability to pay the rent. But at the moment, it sort of says, okay, but a man has to take it away from a woman. So you get this 9 months or up to a year and you have to split it, which is better than it was, but still, like, why can't they both have it?
Yeah.
I don't see why they can't both have it. That, to me, seems... And even if they wanted to take it together, I would never have taken it together because, you know, if you took it separately, you've got 18 solid months of childcare there.
Yeah.
And then free childcare starts to kick in. So you're solving two crises there.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because you mentioned your husband. I know he does... You've spoken about how he does the majority of the childcare. Mm-hmm. But... And that really shouldn't be a thing. But I think it still really is, actually.
Oh, it's totally abnormal.
I don't know very many. I do know a couple of examples, but it's kind of count on one hand type examples.
Oh, yes, it's totally abnormal.
Did he have to give up work to do that, or was he working alongside
and this is, again, why it's slightly abnormal. My husband was a lift engineer when my children were born. He worked a night shift.
Oh, wow.
He worked a shift pattern. Honestly, if you can work out the logistics of how we had to organise our childcare on a shift pattern that is not the same any week after the next, and it rolls. So it's a 4-day rolling shift. So it's 4 days on, 4 days off. So you start on a Monday this week, and then the next week it'd be starting on a Tuesday, and it just constantly rolls. Oh. And so nurseries, when they're like, you have to book in, I was literally like, this is the worst.
But there's so many things that fall outside of all that stuff, isn't
it? Just like a shift pattern. That's not new.
No.
A shift pattern. That's really quite basic part of the environment that we all work in.
Yeah.
But because he had 4 days on, 4 days off, for 4 days of the week, and that could be Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, remember, and sometimes he had to work the weekend, it just worked out so much better for us that he didn't sleep a lot in the first, because I even if you're a night shift worker, if I'm awake in the day, right, and you're there's something disconnect about the amount of sleep that I think you need. I think you need to be in bed till about midday, even if you only got into bed at 8 o'clock.
Yeah.
There's just sort of like, okay, you've had your piece. You're asleep upstairs now.
Yeah.
Get up now.
Yeah, definitely.
And I feel that I definitely had that bad attitude towards his night shift working. So he was able to, and my mum was alive then, and she had retired. And so she was able to do some of it. Both his parents were still in work. But so that really like worked out that it would be, whereas I worked a 9-to-5 job, that he would do the vast majority of it. It's just much better at it than me. He likes playing boring games.
Well, also I think it's good for me, the guilt I associate when someone is looking after my kids that's not me if I'm working. It's significantly less guilt if it's Richard that's got them than if I've got my nanny with them.
Yeah, I feel zero guilt when if it was Tom with them.
That's brilliant.
The only thing I feel guilt for is him, I think. Now, looking back, I feel more guilt that I wasn't more sympathetic, because it's really hard looking after
it is.
Kids.
Definitely.
It's like the hardest job in the world.
Yeah.
And I think I was a bit like, well, why isn't dinner ready? I was probably like a 1950s. 1950s house husband. And still now you can say, because our kids are older now and they really take no looking after, and they're seriously no bother at all. They're more emotional strain than they are physical labour. It's no cold face anymore. But there is an element, I can't believe I'm going to say this, where even though I'm working from home most of the time at the moment, and my husband has a manual job, so he doesn't work from home. It's impossible for him to work from home. So he goes out to work, and still I expect him to make the dinner, even though I'm there. And like, he'll come in and he'll sometimes say, what are we having for dinner? And I'm like, oh, I don't know what I fancy. And he was like, no, I wasn't asking you what you want me to make you. I was suggesting, you know, you've been here all day.
Yeah.
You could have popped a chicken in the oven. I'm like, oh, yeah, like I've forgotten that I could put the dinner on, because I never had to do any of that stuff. I'm a terrible wife.
No, you're not, but it does make me think that if you're someone like me that finds yourself very much, you know, as I said, I'm hoping to raise 5 feminist kids. I very much believe in equality. I'm passionate about women feeling they have all the opportunities and getting that playing field as level as it can be. And yet, my husband as well, he's got all the same ideals as me, but our roles are still quite traditional. And sometimes I wonder how much of it is something that's individual, as in something I should call out and try and address myself, and how much of it is just sort of the fabric of how everything is set up.
It's both, I should imagine,
both,
but most of it is fabric, I would have thought.
Yeah.
Most of it is fabric, because it's like socialism. The people who espouse socialism the most are usually the ones who practice it the least, in my experience. And it's very, very hard, even when you have like the certainty of your ideals, to get everything right and do everything right and not feel like you're sort of, whether it's environmentalism, whether it's feminism, you know, we're all guilty of getting it wrong.
Yeah.
And not even getting it wrong, just putting up with the simpler thing. And that's okay too. Like, I want women to be able to feel like when they make a choice that it doesn't have to be really like thinking consciously about which is the best choice, that just like the path of least resistance is okay too.
Yeah,
it's okay to be like just good enough. I just want people to feel like they're good enough. You don't have to be bloody perfect at anything.
Yeah.
You don't have to be a perfect feminist. You don't have to be... That's why the whole sort of idea of the guilty feminist is a great concept. And it is so true. I remember watching a thing about me giving voice to all these women from Northern Ireland who'd had to travel for an abortion. I stood in the House of Commons and I read out the words, because their own representatives are entirely anti-abortion who sit in the House of Commons, and thought, well, I'll read it out then if these people won't represent the people they are who are voting in their area. I'll do it. And when I watched back the video, it's really, really moving. The whole time all I could think was, I wish I'd put some dry shampoo on my fringe. So, you know, none of us is doing it perfectly, and none of us is the perfect feminist.
No, and actually sometimes when you admit that thing of going good enough is good enough.
Yeah.
I think my most unhappy times as a mum are the times when I've put myself under pressure for some sort of other woman out there somewhere who's getting it done. She's got exactly the same challenges as me, but she's nailing it. And then I'm like, that person doesn't exist. And that, you know, the idea that other families are achieving, like lockdown classic, I was like, oh my God, the homeschooling. I was just like, in my head, all the other families were just nailing it. Their kids were
They're
being
just
obedient.
People just lie, especially people with babies. Biggest liars in the world, worse than politicians. I don't know why we get a bad name. Like, especially old people who had a baby a long time ago. they're the worst. Why are you lying? My mum was literally like, you were eating a roast dinner at 3 weeks. I was like, we just absolutely weren't eating a roast dinner at 3 weeks. And if we were, you were frankly negligent. And it's no wonder some of us have turned out wrong.
That is your reminds me of something in your book as well, where you're saying about like when we're little girls, we're sort of sold this idea of romance as the thing that's going to save us. And like the idea of the guy, the, you know, Cadbury's milk tray man coming in with chocolates. And you're like, I don't want the guy scaling the walls of my house to lay chocolates for me while I'm sleeping. I want, just want someone to take the bins out.
Yeah, just really. Yeah. I like, my aspirations are far, far greater in my opinion. Mm. That I just want someone to like remember which biscuits I like in the supermarket. Exactly. Like that is far more important.
I'm the same at
me.
Home though. Like to me, if Richard makes himself a cup of tea and doesn't make another one for me, that is like, do you
can
still
I just
love
say,
me?
If that were to happen in my house, not from my perspective, but from my husband's perspective, that's literally like selling your firstborn child. Not to
yeah.
I mean, my husband would just, he would kill me.
I think I've shed tears over it before. Like, I know to you it's just a cup of tea, but to me it's a sign that you see me, that you know I've been up for a long time with the little one, and you're just thinking, you know, she probably would like a cup of tea.
I'm glad
this is tapping more than just me.
The greatest guide I have ever had in this regard about the way that we compare people to each other, and what you just said is my husband in the comparing and contrasting with how other people do. He once just said to me, I think it was when Harry was really a tiny baby, when it's like the height of, why isn't my baby sleeping through the night when everybody else's baby sleeps 8 hours from the age of 2 weeks? He just said to me, I can't understand, and can you explain to me why you compare yourself with them? Not even why are you bothering? Just sort of like he genuinely needed me to explain why does it matter what somebody else is doing? What's the benefit to you to be thinking about it? Like he couldn't understand why I was doing it.
Mm.
And I just was like, he's never ever lost a night's sleep worrying about anything because he genuinely thinks worry won't change it.
Mm.
And he can act like he doesn't like just that. Think it. Like, I know that's the case. My mum always said, worry ruins today and doesn't change tomorrow. Like, I know those things, but he genuinely is like, why are you worrying?
Yeah.
And living with somebody like that,
yeah,
who is so straightforward.
Yeah.
And so, like, if he's pissed, if people think I'm up front, Jesus Christ, like, people would invite us out for dinner, and I'd be like, well, we can't get a babysitter, and he'd just be like, we don't want to come. Oh, God, this is terrible. anyway.
You know what, though? I've kind of had dreams where I'm like, I would quite love to live like that. Just, I think I thought that's what being in my 40s would be like, actually. Just, like, I'm just not going to worry anymore. I'm not going to think in those complicated ways, and I'm going to just be much more straight up. That was sort of my goal for my
husband, definitely. If anything, we've infected each other. He's made me more like that, and I've definitely sort of modelled social behaviours that he has picked up in the 15 years that we have been together. But like, I remember when I was pregnant with Harry and we were babysitting a friend's child, which turned out to be a terrible disaster. She was sort of like trying to do me a solid, like, would you like to look after my baby and see what it's like? The baby cried the entire time, and I thought, right, well, I've made a terrible decision. But me and my mate Alex were doing it together, and Tom obviously didn't know about Alex very well because we hadn't been together for a long time before I got pregnant. And he came to pick me up to take me home from babysitting this child, and Alex was there, and I said to Alex, get in the car, and I'll say, oh, Tom, can you give Alex a lift home? And Tom was just like, well, that's actually really inconvenient. No, get out. he would never do that now.
Yeah.
But then I remember just thinking, this is so embarrassing.
Wow.
But he's,
I quite like it, though.
Yeah.
Because also, when it turns out, when people do talk in a way that's quite unapologetic, nobody actually takes it badly because they can see that it's just a real thing. They're not trying to... you know, he's not trying to be rude.
Yeah, like, when people go things like, you know, I hate the name Kevin, and somebody would be like, well, that's my name. My husband would be like, I still don't like it. Like, sucks to be you. Like, essentially would be his reaction. He's like, oh, well, I've just immediately changed my
mind. Does he get the humour in it, though? Does it make him laugh as well?
But also, the funniest thing he does is he will tell hilarious jokes and make out like he's being... and he's not. He can play a totally sort of straight man all the time.
You know what? I get the impression he's going to make a very good old man, husband.
He's
going to nail it.
Oh, he's totally going to nail it. He nailed being a dad. He's now being a husband. He's totally going to nail it. And he looks just like his own dad, who is a total silver fox. And so he's just going to turn into like a debonair old man. He's just going to nail being grumpy about things. It's brilliant.
That's perfect.
I really, really love my husband. I have to say, I feel like it's like I feel slightly bad when people slag off their husbands because I don't really have anything to say.
Yeah, I do actually. Happily, I can agree with that. And weirdly, when people are very confessional about their own bad relationships, I feel compelled to reveal something to bring something. No, that's slightly social awkwardness. But usually, the things that have upset me go as far as, well, actually, sounds like it is quite upsetting. But maybe the tea situation and not making me one or that kind of thing.
My husband would genuinely kick him out of the house if he did that. That would
he doesn't
be.
Do it so often anymore. He's learned from my emotional response.
When my girlfriends sit around and slag off their husbands, usually about childcare or things like that. I always just think I end up just going, oh yeah, I do that. Like I'm the baddie in the situation.
Just hear versions of yourself. Like,
yeah,
oh.
Terrible.
Well, maybe your husband just wanted. It hadn't occurred to him to put the chicken in the oven while he was sat at home working.
Whatever.
So with having the babies and with your, you know, becoming a counsellor and was that influenced by being a mum, or was that just kind of the trajectory you felt like you were already on?
It was definitely influenced by being a mum, because when I fell pregnant with Harry, I felt like I mattered for the first time in my life. And actually not my life. My parents made me feel like I mattered. And I was always confident and clever at school and did well and things. But there was definitely a period in my late teen years and my early 20s that... where I sort of lived out all of those sort of terrible gender stereotypes of having to care for a bad boyfriend who treated me poorly, knocking my confidence, not really having any drive. Then when I was told that I would struggle to have children, basically thinking, well, my body doesn't matter, and all those sorts of terrible, like putting terrible boundaries on myself. And then when I was pregnant with Harry, and when I had Harry, I just thought, you know what? Like you say, check out how special I am. That this is really special, and I matter in the world now. And I understand why young girls end up having babies. Well, they don't so much anymore, but they used to when I was a kid, because it makes them matter in the world. Like you matter to somebody, and being a mum gave me a massive confidence boost. And I know it can go one of two ways, but I was just like, you know, I'm a 25-year-old with two kids. Like, do you know, I can do anything.
Yeah.
Was the reality for me. And so they drove me to be much more ambitious. I was very ambitious as a child, then not very ambitious and very wayward. And then they made me really, really, really ambitious for the future. And for, so everything I do actually is thanks to Harry.
Aww.
He likes to remind me of that. Danny likes to remind him that he's a bastard child and Danny isn't. There's a whole shtick that they do.
I've read that you said that, though, for working women in politics, it's actually harder to be... You think it'd be hard to be a mother in politics, but actually it's the women that... either through choice or through event, have not become mothers that actually have a really tough time.
I think that's definitely true. And more you see it as people start to talk about their experiences much more. Politics has definitely become much more feminised in my time there by the sort of personal story. Mm. And that is because women stood up and bore their souls about things much more so than it ever happened before. But, yeah, so the way that... As an abortion campaigner, the way that I would be treated compared to Stella, who, you know, we were often in lockstep, we did lots of stuff together, and Stella Creasy, the MP, who now has a daughter, Hetty, who is adorable, she's like the tea room mascot, the way she was treated compared to the way that I was treated... that she wanted abortions to be free, safe and legal because she, you know, all she cared about was work and as a woman. And I never got that stuff said to me. And I was public about having had an abortion, and still it was never aimed at me in the same way as the vitriol that she faced. It's this idea of a woman who didn't have a child. And actually what turned out was that she'd really struggled for a long, long, long time to get pregnant and then stay pregnant and had traumatic miscarrages.
So all of that told her must have been...
And then people throwing stuff at her about dead babies she's going through... Now, I knew she was going through that because she's my friend, but the public didn't know that. She has since spoken about it publicly. The public didn't know about it. And just seeing that level of vitriol aimed at her because she was a woman without a child, as if the women who choose not to have a child are in some way deficient and... they're just wrong.
Mm.
You're wrong if you choose not to have a baby. Theresa May very much was treated as if she didn't care about the future because she didn't have children. And it's just like, do you know what? If anything has ever made me want to blow up the entire future, it is dealing with my children. It makes me more likely to press the nuclear button than less likely. I remember my mum would, as later in my life, she became the chair of the Birmingham Mental Health Trust in sort of semi-retirement. She became the chair of this. And she, so she had jurisdiction over people who were sectioned. She used to say to me, I swear to God, I'm going to section you, like a threat. Like, you know, our children bring out the very, very worst of us. We would never talk to other people the way we'd speak to our children.
No.
And I'm like, I don't believe in democracy when it's in my house. I'm like, this is a totalitarian state. You don't have an opinion. And even if you do, it doesn't matter. You have no say in this household.
No.
And so the idea that people like Theresa May, who chose not to have, and that she didn't choose, she couldn't have children is what she has, I believe, said. But that somehow, that she's somehow deficient, not just as a woman, but just as a politician, because she's chosen not to have children.
Yeah.
Even if she chose, you know, one of my very best friends chose not to have children. And... it literally was like, I just don't want that lifestyle.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want that sofa.
Yeah. No,
it's
no,
just like,
got,
fair
I've
enough.
I've got a few friends like that too. And I suppose the sort of uncomfortable subtext of that is that part of what it is to be female is about the nurturing, the maternal, whereas actually it's possible to have all of that and not be a mother. And it's also possible to be a mother and
Have none of it?
Yeah, exactly. So, but it's a sort of a weird box we sort of put people in sometimes of what they're supposed to represent, and actually I think you spoke about in your book as well, like the sort of the pedestal of motherhood as well, and the kind of emerging, like, oh my goodness, saintly person can have a child, and all the things about your life that are then supposed to be shut away in a box, and parts of you as well that turn that down, moderate that, raise this one up, you know, the sort of wholesome nature of parenthood. It's like,
I mean, I can only blame the Virgin Mary for that. I don't think she did it to herself. I feel like she was really put on that pedestal, and the idea that she bore a baby and that this was the sort of first miracle. I know nothing about theology, that could be completely wrong. This sort of sanctity of motherhood, as opposed to the sanctity of fatherhood.
Yeah.
If only we thought that fatherhood was more sacred, you know, potentially we wouldn't end up in a social situation where for some it's very casual.
Yes, exactly. I think you're right. It would put the emphasis there. And also for, you know, men that do feel that those emotions or that role comes more challenging for them, they can actually go and get support more readily rather than it being something where it's like, oh, okay, that turns out I'm just not very good at that, and sort of put in a box some things, which is, you know, is really damaging for everybody affected by that. I wanted to go back to something you touched on, because you mentioned about having an abortion. And I know I've got loads of girlfriends that have been through the same thing, but most of them have still done it where they've sort of sworn me to secrecy. In fact, some of my peers don't even know that they were going through the same experience at the same time. And I've always thought it'd be so much better if people felt they were more able to talk about it. But do you feel like it's becoming less of a taboo?
I probably have an incredibly skewed view of this, because almost all of my girlfriends, like you say, have had abortions, and they don't feel like they wouldn't talk about it in front of us. But maybe that is maybe they don't go around talking about it very much. But
I suppose it's still seen as something, though, that's got this sort of
like you have to come out as having had it. It's just like,
exactly.
Not really, it's just a women's health element. Also, I think that we have to be really, really careful, and I am as guilty of this as anybody. We have to be really careful that when we try and win the argument on abortion, that we go for the very difficult stories, because you know hard cases make people sit up, but they also make bad law. And so it's very easy to go for fatal fetal abnormality. It's very easy to go for children who've been raped, especially when you're talking about in the Irish context. What we were fighting there in the Republic and in the North had got so emotive that you had to go, I suppose, for the emotive argument. And I have definitely fallen for that. But I just want people to know that the vast majority of people who have an abortion are in no way affected by it. And that there has to be a voice for the, you know, the just made the decision, went and had a procedure like any procedure and doesn't think about it as if it was something terrible that happened.
Yeah.
Because the vast majority of people I know who have had abortions, that is their experience. And actually the talk about people being raped or people whose lives were threatened by it doesn't represent those women. And I remember when I went to the clinic in Birmingham, I don't know what that weird noise is. It's a shutter. A shutter next door.
Some sort of sensor or something.
When I went to the clinic in Birmingham and I sat in the waiting room, I remember feeling like, oh gosh, you know, if this is terrible, raised by a feminist. I remember thinking, oh God, you know, I'm not going to be like the people who are in there. And I was just like all of the people in there. Yeah. They were just like me. I knew one woman. I was like, oh, hi.
Yeah.
And that. It's the same for women's refuges. I think that people think it's like bad girls.
Yeah.
It's going to be like prisoner cell like H. And it's just like living in a house. And like living in a block of flats with a lot of other people in a similar situation to you. Where you have a key worker who lives there as well. It's just like, we need to demystify those things that have become about the drama rather than the reality.
No, that's actually a really good way of putting it, about demystifying it. I mean, I remember reading in Catelyn Moran's book, she speaks about having an abortion after she'd had two girls. She says, oh, you know, she found out she was pregnant, went for a scan. She's like, oh, maybe this is going to be my little boy. There he is with his jazz hands. And then she thought, actually, no, this isn't right for my husband and I. This isn't what we're planning right now. And she said something like, you know, if I'm being given the power to create life, I should also have the power to say that's not happening now. And I actually thought that really was such a good way of putting it. It's sort of very matter of fact, but also empowering
many more people to talk about how they've had abortions.
Definitely.
As part of after they've had children, because the idea in most people's heads is young knocked up girls who are and in those circumstances people can understand it. People go, oh well, you know, she had a whole life ahead of her, you know, she'll get around to it in the future, sort of thing. And or people in terrible sort of distress and situations, and
people who are casual about it in a kind of birth control way, which I think is
I intervened on a DUP politician who said that people were using it as birth control, and I said, do you think that I have only had sex 3 times? So because I'm here to tell you I have done it more times than that, so please don't think that, you know, I was like, oh, let's not bother with any birth control tonight, I'll just have an abortion. I mean, how ridiculous. The fact that people still think that and say it in the House of Commons is quite phenomenal. But that, you know, when I had an abortion, it was in between my two children. So I was in a loving relationship, a loving and stable relationship. Mm. And I had a baby. I knew I could, I was, you know, able to do that.
Mm.
It just wasn't right.
Yeah.
It just wasn't the right time. And people say, well, do you ever think that would have been your little girl? And I just think, well, it was just, A, it was just a collection of cells, and B, it isn't, it just isn't
Yeah.
I don't need to think. It's like when Tom was having the snip and I had been and asked if I could be, at the age of 27, if I could be sterilised. And this student was in the room with the student doctor and she gasped. She was like, and she said, but you're only 27. And the doctor said, I think Miss Phillips knows how old she is. You don't need to inform her how old she is. And the but people have when then so they basically said you're too young, no, and it's a much more advanced procedure for you. Get your husband to do it. So my husband at the age of 30, and he didn't have to have any counselling or anything. He was able to make that decision completely without any unlike me. When he
That's
had
interesting,
yeah when
it?
He had the snip, people said, well, what if you change your mind? I said, I want you to realise is that I want him to have the snip because I will change my mind. And when I change my mind and say, let's have another baby, I would like someone to shut a door in my face and say, no, you can't. And every time that has happened, when I thought, oh, it would be quite nice, I go, oh, well, it can't happen. And I go, oh, that's I'm thinking about something else now, whether I'm going to make a chicken for tea. Like, it goes away in a fleeting second. I wanted that door to be shut. So, you know, this whole, it would have been that baby, it would have been this. They just, none of it is real.
Yeah.
None of it is until it is.
It's also incredibly personal, that kind of stuff, you know. Like, if you already knew, like, no more babies, then you know no more babies.
No more babies. I mean, Tom was very certain. I mean, I think it was literally days after Danny was born. I'm getting down that bloody clinic.
When I had my fifth, I had a sort of stand-in consultant for one of the sessions at the hospital, and she said to me, would you like to be sterilised at the same time you give birth? And I did think that was quite a stark question. I kind of was like, oh, I'll ponder it, thanks. But I was just like, wow, that's quite a big question for
someone.
Well,
can I just say, I have heard some terrible stories in my constituency about women, because there is sections of my community, certainly, you know, the Asian community and the Irish community around here, where, you know, the culture of having lots of children is much more common. I mean, you're some sort of weird outlier. Why have you got five children? Are you absolutely mad?
Yes.
I'm constantly saying to women who come into my surgery when they're like, I'm pregnant again, I'm just literally like, what is wrong with you? How can you cope? I just wouldn't. I mean, two is too many, in my opinion. But the horrible, horrible stories about them without them being told or having interpreted for them being sterilised.
Wow.
Terrible, like, you know.
These things knock the wind out of you, don't they?
Yeah, that, I mean, this is not sort of a recent thing, but this is certainly a legacy thing that I've heard about from people who live in my constituency. And that, you know, that, like, there is nothing that I've read or watched on Handmaid's Tale where I can't think of an example of where I've seen that in real life.
And so when you're sort of, you know, taking on board all the stories that are happening around you, is it constantly a source for you of a like an impetus to keep going, to like make change, to fight for their corner, all this sort of thing?
Yeah,
does it ever feel just so overwhelming, you think?
Sometimes it can be overwhelming. More so when I worked in Women's Aid, I remember there were a few occasions where usually things about children the same age as my children being abused, I found so like I was sick once at work. I just vomited it, and that I just thought, actually, this might be too much. But usually, people say, when you see so many bad things, how do you keep hope alive? And actually, the reality is that when you see people who are in a terrible situation, they drip in hope. Because they're bothered to come and see you. Like, and I've met young women who have been in and out of the care system, been raped by relatives, been, like, you know, just pimped out by drug dealers, who get up every day. I just can't even, like, the people who come in here for help are in a desperate situation, but they give me hope. Yeah. About the resilience of the human spirit. Like, they're bothering to get on a bus and come in here. Like, they're amazing survivors. People are capable of so much. And
they
when
really
you
are.
See that people are capable of so much, you think, well, then, if we have all this power inside of us,
yeah,
there's got to be a way of using it for good, and that's what keeps you going. And so it's hard in the pandemic because you don't, you know, I'm not saying, you know, I really want to see people's sod stories, but you're just not, you're not getting the same level of interaction.
And what about when the intensity is much more close to home and there are threats made about you or aggressive things said or threats? How do you sort of deal with that happening?
I mean, you learn, like women learn to take, you know, sexual harassment when they're wearing a school uniform, like it's just part of life. That's like, you know, I wish it wasn't. I'm not saying that as like a good thing, but it sort of becomes like, well, it's just part of the deal. And I'll just cope with it. And then sometimes you fight back, and you fight back aggressively and with wit and humour to try and make sure that people realise you're not hurt. Sometimes you can talk about the hurt because I think it's important to deal with it. But the thing that keeps me going in the hate and everything is that nobody I ever knew who ever changed anything did it without backlash. Nothing like good ever came because somebody went, this is a good idea, and everybody went around the table, oh, that sounds like a good idea. Like that literally has never happened once ever in the history of anything, any progress ever, has it been something that was agreed by consensus early on in its life.
That's very true.
So and I'm much more scared of a world where those people get to silence people. I'm much like, me shutting up and going away and not being a politician anymore in order to get the threats to go away doesn't make the threats go away. So, you know, there's no solution.
It shouldn't really be just part and parcel of public
life. I'm not suggesting that it should at all. It just is at the moment. And we've got to legislate and do all sorts of things to make sure that it isn't. But the... And sometimes it's horrible, and sometimes it will affect you. What the thing that it bothers me the most is that I just feel so tired by it. It's so tiring.
Really tiring.
And it's tiring feeling emotions about it. And I feel tired on behalf of like all the women politicians and all the women's movement and people like my mum who went before. Like, sorry, man, it delivered you like a women-hating fascist online. Like, it's like, dudes, man... You thought it was going to be better, and it actually got a bit worse. So I have to try and find a way to put a hopeful spin on it. And that, you know, you got to face. What did Dolly Parton say? You could get the rain, without, get without, the rain without the rain.
Yeah, good old Dolly. Well, in a more hopeful tone, we are sat in your office where we're behind you is a wall of thank you cards, and I'm just hoping.
This is my favourite one. It's my favourite one. It says, I fucking love you. In like calligraphy.
With like flowers.
It's like flowers. It's like really like chintzy, Laura Ashley. But the inscription is, I fucking love you.
Please tell me that's from the woman whose slabs in her garden were taken away by your husband.
Oh, God. That would be excellent. I'm not sure she ever sent a thank you card.
Oh, what? Come on. You took my paving slabs. Oh, thank you so much for talking to me.
No worries. My pleasure.
Hey, I'm outside in the garden now. You might hear birds tweeting.
Let me see, Mummy.
You might see a Mickey. What's Mummy doing? Am I sitting on a sledge? We used the sledge when it was snowy and we haven't put it back in the attic. It's just sat in the garden. That's not very organised of us, Mickey. Anyway, I hope you liked my chat with Jess. I thought she was brilliant, actually, and I love it when I have a chat with someone and we have lots of giggles as well. And I know I should play it cool, but I've got to be honest, I'm very happy when I manage to tie up the end of a conversation with a joke. Just, I know, I should be like, don't even mention it, just let people think you're really good at that naturally. But actually, I get a very, like, sort of internal high five moment. Oh, just found a spoon in the garden. I shouldn't be there. So who should I speak to next week? Okie dokie. Next week will be Carrie Ad Lloyd, who's had two kids. Her first one was about 4-5 years ago, and then she's also had another baby last year during lockdown, so we spoke about that. And she runs a brilliant podcast called Griefcast. Griefcast is speaking to people about loss. And I suppose, I mean, I've been aware of the podcast for a long time. I've listened to it a lot over the years, but I think it took on special significance to me after I lost my stepdad last year. So we speak about that, and Carrie Ad's also a comedy actress and writer, so we speak about that too. But mainly thanks so much to Jess Phillips for this week's chat. She was exactly as I had hoped she would be, and we had a really, really good time together, and I'm grateful to everyone that said yes to me for the podcast. I've got some lovely guests lined up for this series, and thank you mainly to you, of course, for being here again. And I should probably put the sledge back in the attic. I guess you guys can't help me with that.
Mama.
Yes, Mickey?
I want to take on my shoes on.
You want to take your shoes off?
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to go barefoot in the garden. That's cool with me, man. All right, guys, see you in a... Oh, see, it's cold, isn't it? See you in a week. See you in a week, and thanks very much. And lots of love. Look after yourselves. See you soon.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.